Three, two, one. We are back at our favorite hotel rooftop at Citizen M on Bowery in New York City. I'm your host, Noor Tejuri, and welcome to the season two finale of Podcast Noor. It has been such a delight asking questions and sharing stories with you all, and I'm so grateful for you sticking around. So for this season finale, I would like to take you into the dreamy world of one of our generation's most prolific artists. Sarah Baba is a Palestinian-Jordanian artist and director, born and raised in Australia and now living in Los Angeles. Sarah's photographs are the stuff dreams are made of. Color, luxury, romance, heartache, endless curated food spreads, and almost always paired with a perfectly curated subtitle. Her photograph series often feel like films, and when she's in director mode, sometimes they actually do become dreamy films. When I first came across Sarah's work, I was mesmerized and had really big feelings. So when I learned that Sada grew up in a culturally conservative Arab household, I knew the experiences that led her to make such provocative and bold art were probably also really incredible stories. Sarah's work makes her viewers feel all the feelings because she feels all the feelings. And photography, film, and writing are mediums she uses to process everything. Sada also comes from the ad world. She founded her creative agency Posse in 2016 and has worked with brands like Gucci, Condé Nast, Capitol Records, Sony Music, and GQ. So, with her expertise and keen eye, it is no wonder she's garnered an Instagram audience of a million plus. My favorite series of hers is titled Aib, which infamously is the Arabic word for shame. This was also the first series where Sada herself is finally in front of the camera. It is the story of her relationship with her body, shame, sexuality, culture, relationships, identity, and so much more. It is so beautiful. Earlier this year, she self-published her first book. It is a massive luxury fine art book titled Dear Love, featuring a decade of her work, as well as raw and vulnerable life stories. She opens up intimately about her experience with childhood sexual abuse and even interviews her father about his experience being forced to leave his homeland of Palestine and never really feeling at home anywhere else. And of course, as someone who relates to the experience of growing up in an Arab household, I really dig into asking about Sarah's relationship with her parents and how they feel about her work. And Sada so graciously shares very openly. Honestly, this is such a loving final episode of this season, and we don't ever actually talk about it directly, but this is also the first on-camera interview that I've ever done without my hair covered. So I just wanted to give an extra thank you to Sada for holding that space, because I honestly couldn't imagine having this specific conversation in this way with anyone else. And in Sarah Baba style, I'm even wearing a pink sweater that reads emotional support sweater. So I'm feeling very comforted. In this storytelling session, we discuss unlearning shame through art, going from numbing to feeling, reclaiming our cultures, the tricky relationship with parents not being supportive, peeling back the layers of love, and so much more. Sada does not hold back. And I really think you guys are going to enjoy this conversation. Welcome to the season two finale of Podcast Noor. Sarah, why are we laughing?
I don't know. It's just nice to see you finally.
I know. So we were just talking about how I feel like this conversation is so overdue and also feels like really amazing timing and just divine timing, because you're... Not only are you going through like such a incredible transformation to witness, in that you have, you know, compiled so beautifully the last, it's over a decade of work, or?
Yeah, it's a decade.
A decade, which is pretty remarkable. I think that I've been reflecting on the last decade of my life. And it's like, you know, the number 10 feels so tiny, but in terms of years and in this age period of like your 20s and 30s, it's so transformational. I feel like I change every day. Yeah. And so looking back at it and just like honoring the last decade of your life and last decade of your work, how do you feel like being able to like hug it and look at it in a book?
It feels so therapeutic. It feels like I have like my, it's like I'm honoring like my 20s, because I, 10 years ago was, you know, I turned 20 and then I turned 30 when I decided to make the book. And I really wanted to celebrate the journey that I've been on.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like coming from, you know, very intense childhood of like filled with trauma and like grief and loss and pain, it was, I feel like I had to mature really quickly to like, you know, understand and survive my circumstances. And so I just wanted to honor like that time period of my life in my 20s, because I feel like it was momentous, and there's so many stories within the book that needed to be shared.
Yeah.
And so yeah, it was really a true celebration of like existing and surviving and making it through, because I never thought I'd make it to my 30s, if I'm being honest. So yeah, it's a real celebration.
I'm so happy that you're here.
Thank you. Me too.
How is your heart feeling today?
It's good. If you asked me this yesterday, it would have been a different answer, but I think I just needed to sleep, because last night I got home from my book signing and I was just feeling so emotional, and over something that happened 2 years ago that I just like, it just came up out of the blue, and I was like, okay, I guess I'm going to cry about this right now. And it's like, I had just like repressed little parts of it. And
it's so intense when stuff like that happens.
Yeah.
When you're just like, ooh, that was still in my body.
Yeah. And I was like, why is this showing up for me right now? But I'm just going to like, I literally just like was staring at my knees and I was like, all right, we're just going to feel this. And then I just like started crying, and I just like, but it was so, what I'm trying to do more of is just honor like where I'm at, mm-hmm. even if it doesn't feel good. So,
well, it's also like you're processing it after years of, like maybe a couple of years ago, you wouldn't have been able to physically process it in a way where you're going to feel it all the way through.
Yeah.
And it was ready. And I feel like, especially after a book signing or after you have this massive gathering of people who have been impacted by your work, it's as if like their light is giving you support to be able to kind of move through things.
Yeah, definitely. And like, it's so, I've been saying this, but I, with this book tour, it's been so incredible to see like these rooms full of the people who are behind the likes on Instagram, and like it's so different, because if I got like 300 likes on a post and that's all I got, I would be really like confused and upset. But when you're in a room full of 300 people, it's so different.
So different.
And so like I've just been like sitting down with every single person and like mm-hmm. hearing how my work has impacted them, and it's just like to try and like absorb that has been so overwhelming and mm-hmm. so sweet, but it's like rocking me emotionally. Mm. I'm just like, this is so much love. Like,
yeah.
It's so wild.
Isn't it? But it's so incredible, because, you know, 300 people as human beings is a lot, and it kind of forces you to recalibrate your relationship with numbers and social media.
Yeah.
Because especially when, you know, for you, Instagram is a huge platform for storytelling for your work.
Yeah.
And the impacts that you're making are on real human beings. So when you see people in real life, how does that allow you to recalibrate your relationship with how you use social media?
It reminds me to not be harsh on myself if like my engagement isn't high or whatever, because at the end of the day, like I am such a loved and supported artist, and just because the numbers don't always like reach the highs, it doesn't mean that that's taken away, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, I do, especially because I feel like anytime I speak on being from Palestine or, you know, just share my opinion on anything regarding, you know, the occupation, I do feel like my numbers significantly drop, like 90% dip. Even if the post before was like extremely high.
Yeah. So it's at that point, it's not even about thinking about the numbers around like social media. It's actually just like witnessing censorship and
and feeling the weight of like my identity being silenced by a platform that I built my entire career on has been really like painful for me, because it's like they'll celebrate my art, but they won't celebrate my identity.
Mm.
And so I really try and just be gentle with myself, knowing that, you know, this is like a long-term thing to like be able to discuss mm-hmm. all of that. And like, as long as I can be welcomed into these rooms, that's when I can do the work. But yeah. Instagram is not on my side in that regard.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Okay. So we were talking right before we pressed record and I stopped, you know, I was like, I want to talk about this on the pod. So I had asked you if you'd ever visited Palestine and you were sharing that you hadn't, and you had actually interviewed your dad for the book. And I would love to just know, okay, listen, we're Arab. And so we come from a very specific culture and you do really like daring work, like very brave work, especially when it comes to just centering female stories and asking big questions around culture and tradition and why we do the things that we do and why we don't talk about certain things. And so I want to know how you approached interviewing your dad and just what your relationship with him has been like when it comes to how he engages with your work or what he knows about it.
Okay. So my dad doesn't look at my work. I don't think he ever has. And he's okay with that. I'm okay with that. I would prefer.
Is it like an agreed thing?
Well, it's just he's not active on online. Yeah. So he has no access to it. And he doesn't care to because he would rather just not know. All he cares about is that I'm safe. And I'm, you know, I'm not disobeying him, whatever that means. And because my mom is very unsupportive of my work. She comes from a very Christian background, and she uses that as a weapon to shame me constantly for the art that I create. And my dad is agnostic and doesn't really participate in religion. So he's always in the background being like, Khaliha, like, let her, like, it's art, stop complaining kind of thing.
Whoa.
And so I have like two conflicting sides with my parents. My mom, I unfortunately have had to like sit down with her several times and be like, let's agree to disagree because we both come from two different generations. Yeah. And the work that I'm doing is important, but I don't expect you to understand it, because how could you? Like, you don't live in the same world that I do. I don't need you to understand it. I just need you to trust that I am doing the right thing. And that's always like it's always a battle, because she's just like, but Sara, I want you to be in heaven with me. And like, he really like goes in, and even every single phone conversation we have, even if it's got nothing to do with my work, she'll always end it with, but are you behaving?
What does that mean?
Are you doing God's work? Are you behaving? Are you behaving? That's literally like, she says it in Arabic, but like, she's
very... What is the Arabic? Like, what does she say?
Oh my gosh.
You don't have to, obviously.
Yeah. No, it's just, it's different every time, but it's always centered around like, if I'm honoring God's words.
And what do you think that means to her?
For her, it's fear, because she really does want us to all be in heaven with her.
Yeah.
That's her ideology. That's her belief. She's like, I can't leave this earth unless they're coming with me.
Mm.
And so, which is amazing and it's beautiful, but I'm just not there with her right now. Like, I have my beliefs and it's, yeah, it's tricky. But
when you first knew that you were going to become an artist and that this was the type of work that you wanted to take on, how did you get over that first threshold of being like, oh, this is, mama's not going to be okay with this?
My entire body of work has been an act of rebellion from my culture. But it represents so much more than that. It's also me reclaiming, you know, my body after the things that had happened to me as a child. And I, for the longest time, I blamed my culture for the things that happened to me.
Mm.
And so I was not truly embracing who I was and the people that I came from, because it was built on so much shame.
Mm.
And so when I created Sex and Takeout, for instance, that was one of the more provocative series that I did, and The Wild Ones, which is where I went to music festivals and I got really drunk and I would photograph musicians and like roll around in the dirt and take drugs for the first time and just be extremely like rebellious and doing everything that my parents told me not to do because I didn't feel safe in my culture. So I needed to find a space where I did feel safe and where I could belong and where I could act on desire. But the difference is that I'm out of, and you know, our culture just like cannot accept that we behave in this way. And the Western world was just pulling me in a different direction. They were like, come join us. And it was like the evils and the wilderness. And I was like, yeah, that looks good. Let's go, you know? And so like, it was my way of just escaping, you know, the restrictions and, you know, the shame that was put on me and breaking free. And my art became an outlet for that.
Is it also, as you were saying that, I was like, huh, is it also not just a reaction to the things that happened to you specifically? And in that regard, you are talking about different abuses, forms of abuse, but also a reaction to the fact that there was silence around them, that people wouldn't talk about it. Because I think sexual abuse happens in all cultures and communities, and it doesn't discriminate against anybody.
Yeah.
But there is a way, and this is also, you know, this is a universal thing too, but there is this like lack of response or accountability, or just like don't talk about it, or blame or shame on the person that it's happened to. So I also want to kind of just dig a little bit deeper and be like, is it just a reaction to like someone being like, no, you can't do that, or somebody being like, oh, that happened to you, no, we can't talk about it?
It was a lot of things. I do feel like my voice was silenced as a kid. I didn't really have a voice. Anytime I did speak up, I was always told to be quiet, be submissive, be obedient. And so you leaning into my art to navigate being silenced really did help me build a voice for myself, the voice that I never had. And I was not just doing it for, you know, myself, but it was also for my inner child. Mm-hmm. And she so desperately needed to be heard. And it was really important for me to give her a voice in order for me to truly like heal from the things that had happened to me.
Mm.
Yeah.
And so how did art find you?
Oh, it's within me. It's always been there. It's always been an outlet. When I was a child, it was me introverting in a living room across from where all the adults were gathering. And I would just stare at the ceiling and build these playgrounds in my head that reimagined my entire world to be different and to feel different, to feel safe and to feel colorful. I mean, no, that's colorful is not the right word because our culture is very colorful. But I was creating these playgrounds of safety in my brain. And that manifested into painting as a child and, you know, building like paper mache, like planets and universes. And then in high school, it was like fine art, like oil painting. And then it became photography and now it's film. And it's, I just feel like it's always like different mediums. So, it's a part of me. It's just how I process things.
That's so beautiful. I mean, and it's so clear. Your voice and your vision is so like distinct, and it's so clear. And it's like very beautiful how you have found yourself in so many mediums, but it's still you. So I want to take it back a little bit to what we were talking about earlier. So you have like this response from your mom and from your dad, and when did you realize that, when did you make the decision that you were going to choose yourself and be like, you know what, even if you're not supportive or you're not engaging or you're not agreeing, I love you and I know that you love me and I have to do this?
I don't think there was like a specific moment. All I knew is that there was so much more to me that was like so desperately like dying to be heard. And if I had stayed at home in Perth, in small town Perth, Australia, I would never be able to reach these voices and these experiences and these memories and my identity. It was just so swamped and covered by like core beliefs that were built based on other people's like opinions and of me and like, you know, my family's like conditioning and society's conditioning. And I just like, I became such a shell of a human, and I really didn't feel like I was existing as my most authentic self. And I knew that there was a greater purpose for my existence, and I had to actively go and seek it. And the only way to do that was to leave and not be surrounded by my community and just completely isolate myself and build a world based on what I truly wanted to be and exist in, I guess. And it was, yeah, it was challenging, because leaving everything you've ever known is hard. And it's not that I resisted, you know, the people that I come from. I just resisted myself, and I couldn't understand why I didn't feel like I belonged anywhere. And so I had to go and find belonging. And that was the journey that I went on. And that's when, you know, I really leaned into my art to navigate all of that. So
what did you find in your journey of belonging?
That it's okay. So I write this in my book as well, but I believe that we are born into this world as love, and we have all these layers that are, you know, our core beliefs become these layers and layers, and they take us away from love and who we are. And so when I went on this journey, I was actively peeling every single layer of any time someone made me feel unworthy, or, you know, someone made me feel like I didn't belong, or, you know, someone like invaded my private space, or, and I was just peeling all these layers and beliefs about myself one by one by one until I could find my way back to love. And I want to always exist in our most pure self. And if we can exist as love, then we can access the divine. We can, you know, cultivate these beautiful, loving, you know, reciprocated relationships. But when we're still, you know, layered with all these like beliefs that aren't ours, we don't really truly exist as our authentic self, because we're still acting
in reaction to,
to these beliefs that we've created. It's, I call it like the negative ego. Positive ego is a beautiful thing, because it helps us make really great decisions, but it can also be a dangerous thing if you're acting constantly on the negative beliefs and the negative like parts of your ego. So what I was trying to do is just like peel it all off so I can exist purely as love.
Well, when was the first time you ever felt properly represented in media?
Properly represented? I still don't feel properly represented.
Hey, I'm Noor Tagori, and I've been telling stories my entire life. For my new podcast, Rep, I've spent years examining a more personal story about how the misrepresentation of Muslims in media has impacted American society. I thought I knew the story because I thought I knew my story. But the more I looked for singular, clear answers, the more questions I had. Our story guides include academics, artists, actors, and we bounce around through American history and culture, witness our present and future unfold, and then we find out how these stories affect all of us. Welcome to Rep.
Expression is a space in the heart that is unleashed in let free, it runs wild.
Listen to Rep on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your shows. Okay, so two definitions. In this journey, your book is called Dear Love, and you break it into sections in your own journey of love within yourself and how, like, from your inside out, essentially.
Yeah.
And so how do you define love today? And just because you talked about ego, I'd love to know how you define ego too, because that is like, everybody has a different definition of that as well.
Yeah. So I think ego is mind and love is heart. And both these things are part of the human condition. They're built into us. We have a brain and we have a heart. So, and they're both extremely necessary to exist. So it's not that ego is bad, and it's not that love is the only infinite divine thing. I think what it means to be love and to be aware or self-aware of your mind is to just be aligned and act in, you know, with all your decisions that you make, you always center it around love. So if your mind has the thought, the love is the one that like kind of nurtures it to
its most like authentic place. I don't know how else to like explain it. I still am in the process of trying to like
totally
understand that myself, like the full complete alignment of like mind, body, soul.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, work like compiling Dear Love, what did that journey of actually putting and piecing together the last decade of your work and your own personal evolution, what did that teach you about the concept of love and society's relationship with it?
I think what it has taught me is that self-awareness and being aware of everything you've been through is the most important work that you have to do as a human in order to go back to love.
Yes.
And
yes, yes,
I think
yes, yes.
With social media right now, and it's like a double-edged sword, because on one side it's like there is so many conversations going on around self-work and self-love and, you know, therapy talk and, mm-hmm. you know, it's giving kids access to resources that they never had before, especially if they can't afford therapy. And it's teaching kids how to be a better person and how to go inwards in order to heal from your shit. But then it's also, on the other side of it, it's telling kids to escape from themselves and using their phone as a vice to not, you know, face their reality and not face themselves. So I think with all of that, like, I think most people right now aren't doing the work because they're constantly distracting themselves, whether it's alcohol, partying, drugs, internet, whatever vices that they find. Escapism is still very much present in society and in every room that we walk into. People are constantly trying to escape themselves. And I think I think doing the work and going inwards is the way out of that.
Mm.
And facing yourself and facing mm-hmm. the things that hurt and allowing them to hurt, that's like the work that needs to be done. And that's how you can reach love, like pure love.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How did you do that? How did you face that?
It was a process.
Yeah.
It was a real process. So I was in that escapism world for a really long time. I numbed myself on Xanax and Valium for like 3 years mm-hmm. before I moved to LA. And then when I got here, it was chaos. I was constantly like, I couldn't be alone. I couldn't sit with myself. I was going out every single night, trying to find a sense of safety and community, attaching to these like people who told me I was safe, but would just contradict that in every way. And it was just a constant state of fighting with myself. And I knew it wasn't sustainable. I knew like I wouldn't be able to continue living if I was doing this to my body and avoiding what was going on in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so by the end of my first year in LA, I decided to completely like rehab. I took myself to the desert, and I also had like bulimia at the time, and it's just like everything was like bad. Mm-hmm. It was like I was destroying my body any way I could, and I needed to change, otherwise I wouldn't make it another year. And so I promised I wasn't going to purge again. I stopped taking Valium slowly, and like I stopped drinking. And by 2017 I was completely sober, and mm-hmm. and I started therapy, and I just completely went in. I went in, and I went from feeling nothing and being numb for most of my life to feeling everything all at once. And it goes from like apathy to like a downpour of emotions, like numb, 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 and then downpour, and then back to numb, and then downpour.
Yeah.
And I didn't know how to stabilize my emotions.
Mm.
And that's when I really needed my art to create a space to honor what was going on, to write it all down and kind of go from there.
Thank you for sharing that.
Of course.
Tell me what goes into a Sarah Bahbah vision. Like when you know the storyline, how you see it, like just even down to like the colors and the words, like how do you put together a vision and if we can like start from the inside. Like, so you're in this moment of your art being the medium in which like you can face your emotions out loud in real life. And then you create something that moves millions of people. How does that come together?
It always, it does start from within. So it's me trying to process a situation where I feel like my safety has been taken away from me. And, you know, someone who is extremely, extremely anxious, you know, I've convinced myself I'm constantly in danger. And so whenever I feel the slightest bit of instability in my relationships, it triggers like a wound so deep within me that's that like feels like complete abandonment. And so my brain is just trying to pick up the pieces of like how to feel safe again. And so what that means is reimagining all of my scenarios in which I felt safe, and then how that safety quickly like disappeared. And it's just like I go back to every single moment and I imagine them in 100 different ways. And it's while I'm doing that, that all these subtitles come to be. And then
I love that they're subtitles.
Yeah. They're one-liners. They just pour out of me. Like I can write.
That's harder than writing many words.
Yeah. And also my advertising background taught me to like sell things in 1 minute. So my brain just like knows how to do that. Like one line can like depict like an entire experience. Yeah. And I'm really good at it because I was trained in that way. I was trained to be a one-line person, like, because that's what advertising teaches you.
Wow.
And so I would come up with 100 of these, and you know, it would be over a series of like 3 to 4 months. And once I was ready to release it, I would then plan the visuals, and I would plan the shoot, and I'd find my talent, and everything kind of comes together after that. And then I release it to the world. And once I release it, I know that I'm, you know, I fully processed this feeling of instability, and I fully allowed myself to like accept where I'm at. And so I can give it to the world, and it's no longer mine.
That's so beautiful.
Thank you.
Tell me about the, just like the aesthetic itself, like the colors and the, just like the glamour and the subtitles, and I just, the colors. Like, how did that come to be? How did you find a way to make that part of the voice?
So I, when I was younger, when I first started photography, I would shoot on film. Mm-hmm. And I realized, because I was going to these festivals every single week and I wasn't getting paid to shoot them, I couldn't afford to like process film anymore. So I wanted to make my photos look like film, but they were digital. And so from a really, really young age, and you know, the very, very start of my career, I was already manipulating colors in my photos to capture the essence of what it felt like to be in that moment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I grew up in Perth, and so it's always sunny, and the sunsets are the most beautiful ones you'll ever see. And I really wanted to, you know, encapsulate that in my work, and, you know, really feed on the nostalgia of being at a festival as the sun is setting and everyone's cheering and out of their minds and dancing around, and there's your favorite band in the background. And so color became a huge part of the work. And, you know, in terms of like indulgence, I focus on that a lot in my sets, because I also want to bring in my identity as an Arab. And like what that means is it's covering like the table with food, and, you know, celebrating self and like love through community and indulgence in the meals that we have and the meals that we share. And so I always capture my protagonist surrounded by like a buffet of food, because that really reflects how I grew up.
I love it.
Yeah.
It's so beautiful. And that's also like, so the way I see it too, and I know we started this conversation and it was just kind of like unpacking some of the harm that comes within culture and tradition that we don't really rethink sometimes, but you've also managed to reclaim your culture and to still like maintain it as a part of who you are and your essence. So what was that process like? And how do you continue to do that?
Yeah, so it was a lot of unlearning. I think growing up in Australia and having been bullied by so many white kids saying that I was a dirty Arab and post 9/11 I was a terrorist and whatever shit they could come up with, like,
even in Australia,
even in 100% in Australia, Australians are so fucking racist, it's wild. But not all of them, but
you had that experience.
I had that experience. Yes. And it's, they became a part of my core beliefs, and so I had internalized racism around my own identity.
Yeah.
And I had to unlearn all of that. And the most beautiful, like, takeaway from this journey that I've been on is that we do come from resilient, loud, loving, caring, chaotic people, and it is so worthy of celebration. And there is so much racism and xenophobia around, like, us as Arabs, and it's truly, like, such a miss. It's like we are not any of those things that the media portrays us as. And I knew that. I always knew that. And I love the people that I come from. But it was, there was a disconnect because of the things that were happening to me.
Yeah.
You know, behind closed doors and at school. And so, like, as a child, my beliefs became that we were wrong and we were inherently bad. And that's not true at all.
Yeah. That process of unlearning is like a forever journey too, because it's, again, like, so much of culture and how we engage in it today is in response to how people have treated us or how we've been perceived. And we were talking with a friend earlier this morning about how, like, you know, in, for example, like, my family's from Libya, and when Gaddafi was in power and there were, like, you know, students who were hung in the university square for praying morning prayers. Yeah. And for, and so, like, there are people who, like, you know, really leaned into religion, even my dad included, and they were, like, holding on to it because it's, like, it's, you know, almost a form of rebellion to, like, hold on to your faith in response to somebody who's killing people for it. And then on the other side, my friend who we were talking to this morning, she's Iranian, and her parents fled, or, like, she, she grew up here, and they, like, left in response to the religion becoming this, like, politicized and used as a weapon to oppress people there. And it's like everyone, he kind of, like, responds in reaction to, and it's so difficult because this is part of that journey of, like, figuring out, like, who am I really? Because so much, especially from our cultures, so much of our identity is, like, or so much of our life is spent, like, trying to figure out who we actually are, because so much of who we've been has been in response.
Yeah.
And so I think that art is such a beautiful way to unpack that and release it. And you've done such an amazing job. And, you know, when you released Abe, which is, like, just one of the most profound and powerful projects, the first one you ever did featuring yourself.
Yeah.
And it was, I mean, I would love to know, now that it's been out for 2 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, how do you reflect on that experience? Ayb meaning literally shame in Arabic. And it's funny because, you know, you come from a Palestinian Christian background, and my family is Muslim, and it's, I don't know, the little girl in me who, like, grew up only around, like, very conservative Christian white people, like, meeting, you know, the first time I met an Arab person who wasn't Muslim, I was like, I didn't even know this. It broke my brain. But so to even see you create this body of work that's titled Ayb and, like, feel so familiar and the lines feel so true. And also, like, you know, your mom is referring to God in a very similar way that my own family does. And so there's this, like, we're so similar.
It's, I mean, I think there is so many similarities between Islam and Christianity.
Course, but
also from the Middle East. So, like, my mom, you know, she's very much, like, no different to probably your parents. Yeah. Literally no different.
Tell me about that project from the Sada of today who compiled Dear Love.
Yeah, so I was created during the pandemic, and it was very much created when I was in the process of peeling off the layers.
Yeah.
And I I made the series because I wanted to challenge myself to open the Pandora box of why I didn't feel like I was worthy to be in front of the camera. And
is that how you felt?
Yeah, I did. I felt that way. I felt it tremendously. And, you know, my friend, Stephen, I was on his podcast, Stephen Bartlett, and he said to me, of all the people that I know, you are not one to doubt your abilities, but you're one to doubt the way you look. And he's like, go inwards and figure out why that is. And so...
what a gift.
Yeah. It set me on this journey. It came down to like the memories that I had repressed around my identity, and, you know, also the conditioning from having grown up in Australia and only seeing like white beauty being celebrated, not seeing a single like Arab on TV, even an Arab woman on till this day on TV doesn't really, like, in Western world doesn't exist. It's not, there isn't many of us. And that's the work that I'm doing next, but we'll get into it later. But, it's, for the longest time I was, hiding behind a veil of like blue contacts, avoiding the sun, straightening my hair to like,
I had a blue contacts moment.
Yeah.
When I was 14, literally when I came back from Libya, it was, they gave them to me there.
Oh my
and they
goodness.
Were like, oh my gosh, so you can, my cousin had just worn them for her wedding.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, oh, I'm going to wear blue contacts for my wedding.
You know, it's so funny because I haven't thought of this since, but whenever my sister went to Jordan, she would come back with different contacts.
Yeah. So it's like
so we're just like constantly being told that we are not going to be accepted as the way we look, and we have to alter our physical appearance to cater to white beauty standards. And, you know, I was dyeing my hair, I was starving myself, I wasn't letting my Arab curves kick in, and everything I was doing to my body was to resist my identity. And so, and it was because of the things that I believed about myself, and it's because I didn't feel like I could exist as myself in any space without being ostracized or othered. And so I had to unlearn all that, and that was the true core reasons why I wasn't able to put myself in front of the camera or truly celebrate my identity. And so Ebb was like a marker of that. It was, you know, it was to fight against these Western standards of beauty that I had like succumbed to. And it was also to fight against my culture for shaming me for existing as a woman. And it's like, you know, because I come from the Western world, but I grew up Arab through and through. And this Ebb is like the marker of the third. Like my friend Ratana, she says like, you've got to come into your third. And
what does that mean?
It means like you are both Arab and Western, and you've got to create.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yes. Wow.
And so she's amazing, an incredible artist, and I adore her. Ratana is her name. She's from Saudi, but she lives in LA. Anyway, shout out. She's amazing. So she said that to me, and I was like, okay, what does my third look like? And it looks like me honoring the people that I come from whilst also honoring my sexuality and, you know, celebrating my beauty as an Arab woman and, you know, creating space for that and, you know, hopefully encouraging others to do the same without shame or guilt, you know?
I mean, it looked like a spiritual experience.
It was. It was a journey. It was usually I release my series like right after shooting them, but there were two series that took a really long time to get to a place of being like, okay, we're doing this.
Yeah.
The first was I could not protect her, because that was the first time I spoke about my child sexual abuse and that needed time and nurturing. And then it was because I wanted to check in with my community and make sure that I wasn't going to be expelled from ever being allowed into the Middle East again.
And what was the response to it?
Everyone's like, Sarah, you have to absolutely do this. Like, this is profound. We need this. Go for it. And I was like, okay. But then there was like, you know, a small percentage of like extremists who would like leave nasty comments.
I mean, as always.
Yeah. Like I got one the other day. It was like first class whore. I was like, that's actually nice. Really funny.
That's so wild.
Yeah.
Hi there, Noor here from At Your Service. At Your Service is a storytelling company. We tell stories as a form of service. And the way I think about it is story first, medium second. Meaning, we don't think, hey, I really want to produce a podcast. What should it be about? No, we think of it as we have a story we want to tell. What is the best medium, the best way to tell it? Maybe it is a podcast. Maybe it's a documentary series, a virtual talk, a speaker series, a dinner party. Maybe it's a book club. The list goes on and on. We also love being of service to companies and brands and nonprofits to help them tell the best story possible so that they can serve their audience and their communities. So if you want to check out more of our work, you can do so at ays.media. You can also find the transcripts for all our podcast episodes right there. And if you're enjoying this podcast right now, it would mean so much to me if you could leave a review and give us some feedback. Let us know if you like this style of podcast or if you're looking for something else. And of course, if you have any stories you'd like to pitch for us, you can do that through our website as well. As always, at your service. Are there any women in your family who engaged with Abe?
Yeah, all of my cousins and my siblings celebrated it.
That's beautiful.
Wow. My mom might have seen it. It's still a little undecided. She did go on my Instagram at the end of 2020 somehow, and she sprung me with like, Sada, I saw your Instagram. And it was like,
God, that pit you get in your stomach.
Yeah. I don't know what she saw, but she saw something and she didn't speak to me for a month. So, but she's going to not tell me what she saw. She's going to just be ignorant because it's less painful for her to process that her child has gone astray from God in her eyes. So,
but what is that? Like, what does that mean to her? Do you think specifically, is it about like the body itself or is it about the things that you're saying? Like, what do you think that that actually is?
It's fear based. She could never understand these things. Like she never celebrated her human desires in that way. Right. She played by the book in every single aspect of her life. And so for me, when she sees me in the work that I do, it's so foreign to her.
Yeah.
That it seems like I have like true and like through it's, She feels like I am a danger to everything she's fought so hard against, you know?
But I guess the reason I'm asking is also just because, like, I'm curious how that is, like, for her as a Christian woman compared to, you know, in the Muslim community, like, covering your body is, like, a huge part of, you know, the traditions
yeah.
that people engage in today. So is that similar for her?
Yeah, my mom once would prefer I covered my body, but not like it's just different. It's different, but it's the same. Like,
yeah, that's what I'm like trying to figure. Yeah, I'm like trying to understand.
It is the same, but yeah, you know, you just have different in Islam. They have different practices of covering your body.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, for women, it's you know, obviously it's like their choice and like it. You know, it's really beautiful, but I just in for my mom, she would just prefer that we. Because she dresses so modestly as well. And like when they pray, they cover their hair. Like she's very, very traditional.
Oh,
yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. They wear like a, I don't know what it's called, but it's like a cloth over their hair.
Wow.
And women aren't in, I think she's Orthodox Christian, but it's written in the Bible that women should have their hair covered in the church.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so interesting that your dad is agnostic and that your mom is Christian and that they have like that, you know, the conversation around faith and belief is like, I don't know, different. Like, did that conversation ever come up for you? Like for your dad, is it like go engage in your own spiritual journey or was there more pressure for you to be Christian?
It's been different over the years. There isn't, cause like there was a point where my dad wouldn't let my mom get baptized, for instance. And all my mom wanted was to be baptized so she could take the bread and wine at church.
I thought that was something that happened when they were like younger. You can
not in their.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Not in their traditions.
And what was his like for why?
It was because he didn't like the way that my pastor was not allowing my mom to do it, and like it was like he was trying to protect her out of ego, because you know he didn't like that my mom wasn't being welcomed unless she did the thing that he said she had to do.
Okay.
And so it was out of protection.
Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
Well.
But eventually he came around, but he's never, like, he'll go to Catholic churches for, like, you know, kids' baptisms and stuff, but he's not, he doesn't, like, practice religion. He doesn't, I don't believe he prays.
Do you talk to him about it?
Sometimes. I haven't recently. I haven't in the past few years, but, yeah, he's just happy to, like, he believes there's a God, and, like, that's just, like, that's kind of where he's at.
Cool.
Yeah.
So, wow, this is so beautiful. Thank you for sharing all that.
Of course.
Like, oh, my goodness. I want to talk about your choice to self-publish your book.
Okay.
And just one of the things that I really admire about you and your work is that, you know, you're often using a sliding scale so that your work can be accessible, so that people who can't typically afford like the retail price of a fine art book can afford it, or your prints or whatever. It just feels so in service to the community. And in a way, your choice to self-publish a almost 500 page fine art photography book with beautiful words, like, walk me through the decision. And like, were you nervous?
So I was planning to always publish a book. It was always in the back of my mind as I was building the body of work. And, you know, I was in New York in 2017. I was approached by like these like agents who pitch your books to publishers. And we were just getting really bad deals. And I was like, I think my work is worth more than this. And then,
were they like bad deals that you felt like they were bad deals for you, or generally you're just like, wait, this structure is not good for artists?
I think the
artists.
Structure doesn't favor the artist, but now I'm kind of understanding, like, being the publisher now, I'm like, oh, there is a lot of cost, and it makes sense that they would do that. They would take, you know, they would give you an advance and then pay you the royalties, which is like, I think 10% or 5%. It's low. It's low, but every deal is different, so I can't speak to that. But I just like didn't like these offers that were coming through. And then I met with a really, really big publishing house, and they were saying the same thing. It's like, well, you actually have to pay for it, and then we'll do everything else. And then it was just backwards. And I was like, eh, I don't like any of this. And they were also trying to dictate what the book would be. And I had such a clear vision for it that I didn't really like, it didn't really make sense for me. And I wanted to, you know, I've worked so hard to be an independent artist. I left my galleries many years ago. We won't get into that. But just like,
well, I think it's like a big decision.
They don't put the artist first. Let's just say that. And leaving they go behind your back.
Leaving agencies. Yeah. We left an agency years ago and we started our own thing. And that's why I feel like I can see and I can feel and taste the freedom almost that you have. That is incredibly challenging. Like, doesn't mean it's easy at all, but
it's not, it's definitely not easy. Cause like you have to literally work every single hour of the day to make sure that you are getting every single thing done that people have teams for. But it's just, you know, at the end of 2017, I left all these galleries, and by 2018 I released my first like limited edition print, and instead of the works being sold for thousands of dollars, I wanted to democratize my art and make it more accessible. So we did a print that was like $200, and then like by the pandemic, I did this sliding scale where it's like you can pay $50 or up to $300. And honestly, like old institutions do not support it because it goes against everything that they've worked to control artists. And I want to keep pushing against the grain because I believe that, you know, it also makes me feel like I could do anything, knowing that I could publish a book or sell 25,000 prints or whatever. You know, it's like I did that.
Yeah, you did.
No one else did that. I did that.
Yeah.
And that feels really fucking good to own. And so I, like, you know, when the book came around, I had a choice. I was like, do I want to start pitching this again and going to all these publishers? Or do I want to leverage the audience that I have?
Yeah.
And, you know, knowing that they support my work, mm-hmm. and knowing that I can price it so it's still accessible. Mm-hmm. Because if I went with a publisher, they would sell this book for like minimum $300. I already know that. And I would only get like $10 from it. So it's...
That's bonkers.
Yeah, it's bonkers. But so that's what I did. I spent every single hour last year, like 12, 16-hour days working on this book and, you know, project managing it, making sure through and through the process was like clear and greenlit. I had a beautiful team of editors. I had a graphic designer. I had legal, like, make sure all the talent was cleared, and it was just all the art was cleared, and it was a process. And then going back and forth with the printers on like the cover and the quality of the book and the size and like, how much are you going to order? How many books do you think you can sell? And like, not knowing what number, because obviously the more books you order, the more, the lower the cost is. And I'm like, okay, I had to like weigh out the margins, but then there's also a recession and people aren't buying things right now. So it's like, what do I do? And it was just so many questions that I had to answer myself. I didn't have a team for this. That's what it means to self-publish. You are the boss. You literally have to make every single decision. And I loved it, but it destroyed me at the same time because it was so hard. It was really, really hard. And I burnt myself out a million times through.
How did you keep going?
It was, honestly, there was moments even this year where I'm like, I need to just disappear for a month and not speak to anyone because I'm so exhausted. But I pushed through. I just like, I started to be more gentle on myself. I mm-hmm. think it was like, once the book finally was out, it didn't end. I had to also do customer service while I found a customer service team. And this is for like, at the time it was like 6,000 orders.
You're like saying all of these things that I'm like, never would have thought of that.
I was literally replying to customers every day. Like 100 customers would email every single day, hundreds of customers. And I'm literally sitting behind the computer trying to respond to them while being like, okay, to my shipping team, what's the update? And then getting a fulfillment company is also another thing. And then working out what that looks like, working out what your packaging looks like. And like, there's so many things.
Yeah.
It doesn't end. It literally doesn't end. And so now I'm like on book tour mode and everything is finally in place. I have amazing packaging. It's not going to damage the books. And like, you know, we're shipping daily and everything's like, it just like, it was like the longest teething process of my life.
Oh my gosh.
But now everything is settled.
Beautiful.
And now I have to like look at distribution and how I can actually get my book into bookstores, because unless you're with a distribution company, they don't want your book.
Wait, really?
Yes. Barnes and Noble's literally got back to me yesterday and they're like, we only accept self-published books if you distribute within these companies. And they gave me a long list and I was like, okay. And so I look into distribution. Distribution is 70% to the distributor, 30% to the artist. And they sell your book for half the price. So I'm like, do I even want distribution or should I just go hard on like selling my book online and like, you know, focusing all my energy on literally just like getting people to buy the book through like Instagram ads and whatever. Yeah.
I mean, it's hard though too, because it's like, you know, bookstores, you're getting people who've never heard of you before.
Yeah.
And you're really breaking a model though. I have a lot of questions, like, and not ones that can be answered, but just things that it seems like you found a lot of holes in the system.
Yeah.
And you know, this is only your first book. I know that this is not the last. Maybe it will be. Maybe. Who knows? I don't know. Yeah, I feel like you going that route has been such a service to other artists to say, I mean, listen, it's hard work, but like it's something is possible and you've.
Yeah. But I will say that if I didn't have my audience, this book would not be successful.
Exactly.
But yeah. I also like cultivated this audience over 10 years.
Yeah.
And like, I have built such a strong community of supporters that I love and adore. And, you know, that's why this book tour is so important, because I really want to like thank them. I want to be there. Yeah. I want to like literally say thank you.
Yeah.
And because they made it happen.
Totally. Who are they? Who is your audience? And I love seeing their faces at your events, and they're coming through and they're so emotional and like feel so attached to your work. Who are they?
I think, very loving, caring, you know, very gentle people. I haven't met anyone who's just, you know, been unkind. It's just like everyone is so open.
Yeah.
And I think the people who follow my work and support my work are on the same path of like going inwards and leaning into vulnerability to truly express themselves to their partners and, you know, in their life. I think we all connect because we all want to be seen, and we all want to have a voice, especially in our relationships, around love. And yeah, it's just been so beautiful to have people share their stories with me and how like my art has directly helped them, you know, heal from a breakup.
Yeah.
And like, that's like the most common thing I'm hearing. Your art has helped me heal from my breakup, or I literally use your art to break up with my ex. Or, and like, it's just like,
no pressure.
Amazing. No, it's so beautiful, because it's so like good. By me giving the chaos in my brain, like a space, it helps others also do the same.
Yeah.
And so, you know, by me doing the work, it's helping others do the work. And I'm like, okay, that's cool. I like that.
Yeah. That's the radical thing, is like when you actually engage with your own story and you create the space in your life for you to engage with it, there's no like, this is why this idea of trying to change people is such a farce, because like, you can't change people. You can only change yourself. Yeah. You also have to trust that in changing and evolving yourself, you are also going, like, you're showing people how to do that for themselves. And that's the impact that you make.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, this is funny, because it was like one of the first questions I asked, and then I realized, oh my gosh, wait, I didn't get the answer. You interviewed your dad for the book. Tell me about that.
Okay, so we didn't answer that question.
It's perfect. I feel like we're having like the parent conversations as like a little, like we talk about it and then we go into like art and then we talk about it and we go into, and it feels good.
Yeah. So I interviewed my dad for the book because I wanted to understand where he was at with the occupation in Palestine. Mm-hmm. I also wanted to understand his history more, because like, he's never been able to openly like talk about it, and we've never set intentional time to talk about it. So I had my best friend Bahar, who interviewed them at the house, because she was also one of the editors on my book.
Interviewed who?
My parents.
Both of them.
Yeah, so she went to Perth, she lives in Perth, and she interviewed them, and I was on the Zoom call.
Whoa.
In Istanbul before a wedding, so it was like, I didn't expect.
Huh.
Yeah, I didn't know where it was going to go, but I ended up sobbing, because hearing my dad speak of, you know, the occupation, because he was born in 1949 and Nakba was 1948. Mm-hmm. And in 1948, it was very different than when he was born. 1948, my grandpa and his dad had a very large orchard farm. Mm-hmm. How do you say it?
Orchard.
He had a large orchard farm. It had olives and oranges, and you know, they were harvesting, and Nakba happened, and literally like within the same week the Israeli occupation force came to their land, and they tried to buy it at first. They're like, can we buy it off you? And my granddad was like, no, this is ours. And the very next day they came and they burnt it to the ground. They bulldozed it and they displaced my dad's family from their home, and they got sent to Tabor in Ramallah. And then my dad was born the following year in a basement. And in order for my dad's family to stay in Palestine, my granddad had to work for the occupation force, and he made like the horse shoes. And he also made wine, and there was like one other thing, like soap or something. But
you didn't know this before your dad shared it this time?
No, I didn't know, and because he never spoke about it.
Yeah.
And so
And how was he during the interview?
He was just, he was very calm, but he was like, you could see he was like, it's hard for him. And then, after 5 years, in Ramallah, they were displaced and they went to Jordan, and then they went to Qatar. So that was like my dad's journey out of Palestine. And then for my grandma, she was born in Jaffa. And sorry,
this is your grandfather's wife.
No,
grandmother.
Both my grandmas were born in Jaffa, actually. Okay. My grandma was married off to a Jordanian man in Idlib, Jordan, at 13, so they could leave. And her whole family weren't allowed to come except her dad and her dad's brother. So that was like their way out. And then everyone else stayed in Palestine and eventually moved to Gaza. So, or were moved to Gaza, I should say. And a lot of them are still over there, if they're alive. And yeah, so that's kind of their story. And when I asked my dad why he doesn't want to go back, that's what broke my heart, because it was the first time I really felt him speak on how he felt like he doesn't have a home. And he doesn't feel like he belongs anywhere because the home that he knows isn't the same anymore. And he also had a bit of adversity around being Christian in Qatar and being ostracized by like his Muslim peers and not accepted at school. And like, even though he was the best in the class, he was never honored because of his religion. So like, and then he comes to Australia and he doesn't understand the curriculum because it's not in Arabic. So it's like, he just like never really felt like he had a home. It was always taken away or he was never accepted. And that broke my heart. I couldn't even like fathom, cause like I always felt his grief as a child. I'm extremely empathetic and I felt his sadness continuously. And like, cause he would sit in silence and like blast like opera music and it would be like 11 in the morning and like the house, he's like put speakers in every room and he's just like sitting there like wiggling his feet, just like eyes closed, and like that's his like way of like feeling. And he's done that ever since I was a kid, but it was always so sad for me to see that because it was like Simon and Garfunkel, like Sound of Silence kind of thing, and like Andre Pacelli, like real like
emotional.
Yeah. And so yeah, it just, I finally like understood the grief he was carrying. It wasn't just like the like material things that I thought it was. It was of having lost everything once he came to Australia. It was just like a lineage of like trauma and And so it's hard for him, but I think I've convinced him to go back. So we're going to potentially go soon.
What do you mean you've convinced him?
To go to Palestine, because I wanted to go with them.
Hi there. I want to share with you a good deed opportunity. At ICU Foundation, we work to alleviate local homelessness and directly serve community members in need. We do this through our community pantry, family food bags, hygiene kits, snack bags, winter care packages, and grocery gift cards. Lately, we've been seeing incredible impact by partnering with businesses and organizations to host volunteer events where their teams make and distribute the ICU care bags. ICU is our response to a community member who, when we asked what she needed most, responded with, "We just need to be seen." So, if you would like to join us in seeing and serving the community, email us at contact@isyfoundation.org. Okay, back to the show. So that's what I was going to ask next is like, so how does that impact your decision to go and how do you feel about going?
I feel honestly, I'm avoiding it because I can hardly like process the things that I see online, and I just like don't even know how I'm gonna cope. I think it's gonna destroy me in ways that I'm not prepared for, because I already spiral if I think too much about it.
Yeah.
And like, but I am also mentally preparing because I know there is so much beauty to be seen.
Yeah.
And like, I want to go to Jerusalem. I want to spend time in Ramallah. There's so many young, buzzing creatives. I want to eat all our food. And yeah. I got to make sure that before I go, I am so mentally grounded and stable, because I struggle so much with mental illness that like I'm just worried it's going to it's going to shock me in ways that I.
But I also wonder if I feel like a trip there for you especially is kind of like a pilgrimage. It's like you connecting to a bigger part of yourself that you've never met. And so I wonder if also like you would be carried by your ancestors and surrounded by people. I feel this way when I go to like Arab countries, even like when I'm not from there, and there's like this there's this lightness because there's a familiarity, and I'm like, I can't believe I'm hearing the language that my family speaks like everywhere. Yeah. And you know, when I speak it, it's very broken, but I want to, and there's just like this desire. And so I wonder if that'll come through for you, and just I feel like especially you, and especially as an artist, and it's a part of your story that you'll be so carried, and you kind of have to just trust that all the work that you've done, it's not even about like mentally preparing from now until you leave. It's like you've been doing this since you were a child.
Yeah.
Like you've been preparing for this more than you know.
Yeah. Yeah. I believe that. And I know I have so many homes that I'll be welcomed into, and like, I know I'll be celebrated and loved and adored. I just don't think there is a lot of anger. I'm carrying, you know, my family's anger. I'm carrying, you know, our people's anger. And like, I'm just scared.
Of course.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I honor your journey and your feelings with
Thank
that.
You.
That's so, I
Thank you.
I want it for you so much. And I think that I hope that inshallah it'll be so healing whenever it happens.
Thank you.
So what's a question that you're currently asking yourself these days?
This is one of your questions. I didn't prepare for it. Let me think.
Great. We can sit in silence until one comes to you.
Okay. I mean, I'm in a phase of like truly trying to embody self-acceptance, and I'm asking myself, what exactly does that look like? Because it's something I practice and it's something I preach a lot. Like, you know, love is self-acceptance and accepting yourself in all of your parts and as whole, no matter, you know, how damaged or broken you feel, you have to honor that. And like, and so I guess, I'm constantly asking myself, what does true self-acceptance look like? And how do I integrate that into my daily practice? And so that means when I'm feeling anxious or when I'm feeling, you know, like groggy or exhausted, like how do I just like sit and celebrate that? Celebrate it as much as I celebrate, you know, feelings of joy and excitement.
Totally.
Yeah.
You know, I forgot where I learned this from, but it's been a really helpful practice for even what you're saying. And it was like, because language obviously is a huge part of that, and the words that we use to define our feelings or whatever it is. Brené Brown has Atlas of the Heart that speaks to a lot of like different emotions that we can talk about. But instead of saying like, I feel sad, I've started saying, oh, sadness is present.
Yeah.
Instead of like making it like I am this feeling, it's just like the feeling has shown up. And I wish I remembered where I learned this from, but when I started doing that, it was such a like, I don't know, it was like an unlock in my brain, because I began to like exist as a witness to what was happening rather than a victim of it.
I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this feeling is present right now. Oh, okay. Like anxiety is present right now. Oh, that's, well, I'm not anxiety, but like, how do we kind of look at it from afar?
Yeah. That's so beautiful. And that's definitely like something that I've tried to, practice often. I like feel like emotions are visitors.
Yeah.
Ooh. And they just like attach to you and you're like, oh hey, what are you doing?
Next series.
Yeah.
Next Sarah Bava series.
they just want to be like cuddled and heard, and so they can leave. And that's
totally
really what emotions are.
I love that.
Yeah.
So the way we this conversation has been great. I could talk to you for hours.
Truly.
Thank you. The way we wrap our conversations is a fill in the blank. So the prompt is, if you really knew me, you would know, and you can share. Yeah, yeah, I'll do the whole thing. Yeah. Okay. So we wrap our conversations by a prompt.
Okay.
And the prompt is, if you really knew me, you would know, and you can share one, two, or three things.
Okay. All right.
You're like, I already shared everything.
No, there's so much. Okay. If you really knew me, you would know I am an extremely introverted person, and it's really hard for me to connect with people. And feel like authentic connection. And, you know, I practice openness so much. And when I'm in a room full of strangers, I shut down completely. And it's really hard for me to stay open. So, yeah, number one, I'm an introvert. Number two, number two. Oh my God, this is so hard. Can I think of anything else? I don't know. I'm a really good cook. My friends are obsessed with this. I call it the famous spicy vodka sauce now, because everyone is just like, when are you making it next?
Yes.
So I've started doing these annual gatherings at my house, where it's like long fold out tables with like checkered red tablecloths. And I have like 60 friends come over, and I just make a huge batch.
That's
amazing.
And I
feed everyone, and I, you know, we have wine, and it's just like a true celebration of this pasta.
That's amazing.
And so I do that once a year. And yeah, I guess if you really knew me, you would know how good that pasta tastes. And then the third thing is, if you really knew me, you would know I curate playlists a lot.
Your birthday playlist is one that when you shared it, your birthday Spotify playlist last year, I literally, was it last year? Maybe the year before. Anyway, I downloaded it and I listened to it I love it so much. I didn't skip a single song.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, it's because we're from the same generation.
I know. It was a lot of early 2000s, late 90s. And I was like, yes, thank you.
Yeah. So I would say, I think anyone who is in my life knows that I am really good at curating experiences.
Yeah.
And so like a lot of what you see in my art,
yes,
manifests into my like personal life as well.
That's so good to hear.
And so if I have a dinner, like it's going to look beautiful. If I have a castle party with like, you know, 30 of my friends or 20, I think I had like 20.
That was the playlist.
22 people there. You know, I'm going to take you on a journey.
Yeah.
And there's going to be so many like thoughtful, intentional, like activities like throughout the entire weekend. And I just love curating spaces. I like to make my art come to life in so many ways, and only my friends get to experience it. And that's really like fun for me.
You created the world that you wanted to live in.
Yeah.
That's a really beautiful thing.
Thank you.
Thanks, Sara.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So great.
This has been so beautiful.
Thanks.
Yeah, you're amazing.
Podcast Nude is an At Your Service production. Producers include myself, Adam Khafif, and Sara Issa. Editing by Nuran Morsi. The theme music is the song Thunderdome, Welcome to America by Portugal the Man. Extra gratitude and thanks to our storyteller, Sara Bahbah. And be sure to get a copy of her book, Dear Love. Also, thank you to Citizen M Hotel for this beautiful mobile studio that we've used pretty frequently throughout this season. As always, at your service.